Well, good evening. We are once again looking into the Gospels and taking an individual that Jesus met and seeing how he interacted with this person and what we can learn about how we relate to Jesus and what Jesus does for us, as well as learning quite a bit about how we are to interact with other people, especially in the work of the Gospel. We've got actually some readings coming up and some classes coming up where we're putting two people together. But many of these are appropriate to just look at one individual in Jesus, and such is the case in John 9 here tonight. So very glad that we're together and we can do this. And Neil, would you lead us in a prayer as we start class?
Heavenly Father, we thank you for this day, the opportunity that we have to come together as humans of like mind, faithfulness to you as Christians. Thankful for this life, this land. Most thankful, Lord, for this word and hope that it brings. We pray that you will help us listen, open our hearts, put our biases aside, and learn your word, your way, your intentions, first and foremost. Be with those around us who are not able to be here. Pray that you will bless them. Pray that they will be able to listen in and gain what they can from this situation. We prefer them to be here if possible, for we are strengthened as they are. Watch over us and keep us. In Christ's name we pray. Amen.
So tonight we're going to look at a man who from birth was blind. What would that be like? Never to have the function of your eyes. What strikes you about that condition?
You have no perception of size.
Size, depth, color, you know, those kinds of things. Yeah, that's exactly right. What's that again? Yeah, it's true. He's never seen a sunset or a sunrise, but he never saw his mother's face, those kinds of things. And so you're right, there is a reference that's not there that you're not missing. But of course, if you've been around someone who is visually impaired or completely blind, you know that they compensate. I think if you've had a friend or a relative that was blind, you understand that. And it's quite remarkable how they compensate. I've got some stories. I had a friend in college that was like that. And I hadn't seen him in 20 years, and he touched my arm, and he got me in two guesses who I was.
That's,
here at the church, okay? Okay. So it's amazing what they can pick up on, what they're sensitive to. And I think this is really a chapter a lot about perception. At a lot of different levels and different angles. In Luke chapter 7, we're told over in his gospel, and I'll just refer to this here, John is in prison and he is evidently struggling with what's going on, but he sends disciples to ask, are you the one? Are you the Messiah? And Jesus responds and says in Luke 7 verse 22, go and tell John what you've seen and heard. The blind receive their sight, the lame walk, lepers are cleansed, and the deaf hear, the dead are raised up, the poor have good news preached to them. So the blind receiving sight was an indicator of the coming of the Messiah. And we have several incidents of Jesus healing blind people. This one is the most fleshed out here in John chapter 9. Because we see a lot more about the background, we see more about the consequences, the fallout from this healing, and we see that Jesus has more interaction with him. So let's look at this here, John chapter 9. We're going to start, we're going to take this in sections, and let's look here at verses 1 through 7 and look at the healing incident itself. So John chapter 9, Earl, would you read for us 1 through 7, please?
And as he passed by, he saw a man blind from birth. And his disciples asked him, saying, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he should be born blind? Jesus answered, it was neither that this man sinned, nor his parents, but it was in order that the works of God might be displayed in him. We must work the works of him who sent me as long as it is day. Night is coming when no man can work. While I am in the world, I am the light of the world. When he had said this, he spat on the ground and made clay of a spittle and applied the clay to his eyes. And he said to him, go wash in the pool of Siloam, which is translated sin. And so he went away and washed and came back seeing.
All right. Thank you very much. Call your attention, first of all, to this very simple statement, which is easy to underestimate. As Jesus passed by, he saw a man. When you look at the context of John chapter 9, it seems to merge in with John 8 and John 10 in the sense that he's probably still in Jerusalem and working in around that temple area. And here he sees this blind man, as we see later on, actually begging. He's a beggar. He saw a man. Now, this expression is really rich. Because this is a man who can't see. He's going to receive sight. And we're introduced in this incident with the statement, Jesus saw him. Jesus saw him first. And especially when you consider that crowds of people follow Jesus, and oftentimes large numbers of people were thronging Jesus. And it's much like, as we'll see here in an upcoming lesson, about the woman with an issue of blood and Jairus, that incident, and he's on the way to Jairus' house to heal his daughter, and the woman touches him, receives healing, and he stops, he says, who touched me? And the disciples are like, what do you mean who touched you? You're being thronged. There are people everywhere. He saw a man. The text is telling us that this was a deliberate action. This is not like he's just glancing around, but rather he's deliberately seeing this man. And so I want you to think about three levels of this, and right off the bat, this teaches us volumes about relationships. First of all, this is about him noticing the man. This is about him perceiving the man where the man's at. And this is about connecting to the man. And it's really a fair question. Do we really see the people around us? Are we aware of them? Where they're at? What they're experiencing? Are we perceptive? Do we have the antenna out and we're picking up signals? Jesus was. This is a hallmark characteristic of Jesus, really. So what was the question the disciples had when Jesus sees him? And evidently, their attention, once Jesus sees him, their attention is drawn to this man too, because Jesus is focused on him. So then they have a question. What's the question? Who sinned that this man was born blind? Was it his parents? His parents did something. That's why the baby that was born to them was born blind. And then I don't even want to open this can of worms. How can the man be born blind because of his own sin? Okay. And we all understand that Calvinist doctrine of original sin is not a biblical idea. You don't see it certainly in the New Testament and anything Jesus talks about. And there were some Jewish rabbis at the time who actually had a theory about pre-existence before birth. Okay, so again, I don't want to open this can of worms because Jesus doesn't let them open it. He just completely diverts this question onto something else. And he says it's not because of his sin or somebody else's sin, like his parents' sin. What was Jesus' stated purpose here as to why this man is in this condition? Right, so God's glorified here. Big question. It's certainly a biblical question. It's a legitimate question. And like the other point that I was just making about being born and sinning and being born. And that is, does God allow things to happen so that he can accomplish his purposes? And you can make the case, certainly from Job, That is so, although what Job experiences is not at God's hands, it's at Satan's hand. But certainly God uses those things. But nonetheless, Jesus diverts their attention from some kind of sin behind this affliction to the idea of God being glorified. And so we've noted recently that there are some occasions when Jesus does tie sin to someone's physical affliction. But this is one where he is definitely saying there is a disconnect between the two. Now, what about the manner of healing? How does he heal him of his blindness?
With the clay from the spit.
So he takes his spit and he takes some dirt and he makes a mud or a clay, he makes a pasty substance, puts it on the man's eyes, and then what? Tells men to go wash, and even tells him where to go wash. Now, does Jesus always, when he heals a person, or even when he heals a blind person, when Jesus heals a blind person, he does it several times, does he always use this method? No, he doesn't. One other time he touched the eyes. Another time he spat on the eyes. Don't be grossed out, okay? The text says he actually spat on the eyes. And then another time, it appears that with Bartimaeus, who is the one blind person that's mentioned by name, and that's in Mark chapter 10, that he healed him with words alone. Be healed. He was healed. Because he's the Son of God. He has the power to speak or to gesture or to touch and to release the power of healing. But this is interesting. He makes this little paste, this mud, this clay, and puts on this man's eye, and he goes and he washes and he's healed. When I was reading that yesterday, and I was thinking about that, that's the first, I'm thinking, okay, what is this about? What's it connected? That's the first thing I thought of, is that humans were made from the dust of the earth back in Genesis. You're exactly right. And here, and it's so with any kind of healing, it's really a regeneration, right? So these are eyes that don't work or someone's legs that don't work. And so what Christ is doing is he's recreating their legs. He's recreating their spine. He's recreating their ears or their eyes here. And it's interesting how that dirt is connected to that. It's very interesting. And I think that plenty of things happen in Jesus' ministry that tie him back to creative power, like, you know, commanding the wind and the waves and things such as that. Does this remind you of anything else in the Old Testament about going and washing in a certain body of water? Yeah, Naaman in 2 Kings chapter 5 and Elisha, Naaman the Syrian commander who was smitten with leprosy and came to Israel where he was told to see the prophet Elijah. He does. Elisha says, go wash in the Jordan 7 times. Was Naaman's healing, did it have anything to do with the Jordan? Or 7 times? No. That's what he was told to do, and he did it. And he was encouraged to do that by a servant, and he is healed. And so the power is not in the dirt. It's not in necessarily the spittle. It's not in the pool of Siloam here that he goes and washes in. The power is in Christ. But sometimes, like the case of Naaman, along with the healing power of God, is an action that is required on the person to act upon their faith. I mean, you could say the man's desperate, so he's going to try anything, but he just goes and does exactly what Jesus says to do, and he's healed because of it. So, it's a very interesting healing here, and it's a very personal one where he's touching the man and things such as that, and he's involving the man in it. A couple of the other blindness incidents, the people actually asked Jesus to heal them. That doesn't seem to be the case here, right? He just heals him. Okay, anything on the healing itself before we proceed regarding the fallout? Yeah, Earl?
This seems to be kind of a shadow of our receiving sight spiritually. This man was a co-participant. We're co-participants. God tells us what to do, and we have to go do it.
Yeah.
If we don't do it, we're not going to receive our spiritual sight.
Right. And there's even a washing involved, which is very, you know, portends conversion too, where there's a washing. Yes.
Because the apostles or disciples gave him two incorrect answers. And so something to learn from that, in that two choices are not always the whole truth. Like, a lot of times people give you two false choices.
Either or.
Like a salesman, for example, you know, give you two, would you like a red one or a blue one? And you, one of the choices is not neither one of those. But in this situation, Jesus gives a correct answer, not either one of the choices that were given to him. And so we have to remember that when we're talking to people, because a lot of times people have in their minds two wrong ideas, and oftentimes the truth is in the third one. Mm.
Isn't it remarkable how Jesus has this ability? Of course, we shouldn't be surprised by it. But Christ demonstrates this ability to never be pulled down into an intellectual pit. You're right. It's like, which one is it? What's neither one? But it's easy to get pulled down into that. It's like, do you still beat your wife? That kind of thing. Okay, it's a trick kind of thing when you get pulled down into it. Jesus never gets pulled down into a pit intellectually. He sees all those traps. He never steps into one. And it's remarkable. That's a study in and of itself. But he certainly proves that right here. And I don't think the disciples were had bad intentions, like you see with the Pharisees and scribes in Matthew 23, where they're trying to set him up and things like that in Matthew 22. But they are wrong. And so he gears things in the right direction here. Okay. Let's look at what happens after this man is healed. It's huge. Reckon now you're at the command, but are you in good shape to read? Okay. Start with this in verse 8. I'm going to have you read verse 8 down to verse 23, okay? 8 to 23. John 9, 8 to 23.
The neighbors, therefore, and those who previously saw him as a beggar were saying, "Is not this the one who used to sit and beg?" Others were saying, "This is he." Still others were saying, "No, but he is like him." He kept saying, "I am the one." Therefore, they were saying to him, "How then were your eyes opened?" He answered, "The man who was called Jesus made clay and anointed my eyes and said to me, 'Go to Siloam and wash.' So I went away and washed, and I received sight." And they said to him, "Where is he?" He said, "I do not know." They brought to the Pharisees him who was formerly blind. Now it was a Sabbath on the day when Jesus made the clay and opened his eyes. Again, therefore, the Pharisees also were asking him how he received his sight. And he said to them, "He applied clay to my eyes, and I washed, and I see." Therefore, some of the Pharisees were saying, "This man is not from God, because he does not keep the Sabbath." But others were saying, "How can a man who is a sinner perform such signs?" And there was a division among them. They said, therefore, to the blind man again, "What do you say about him, since he opened your eyes?" And he said, "He is a prophet." The Jews, therefore, did not believe it of him that he had been blind and had received sight, until they called the parents of the very one who had received his sight and questioned them, saying, "Is this your son who you say was born blind? Then how does he now see?" His parents answered them and said, "We know that this is our son and that he was born blind, but how he now sees, we do not know, or who opened his eyes, we do not know. Ask him, he is of age, he shall speak for himself." His parents said this because they were afraid of the Jews, for the Jews had already agreed that if anyone should confess him to be Christ, he should be put out of the synagogue. For this reason, his parents said, "He is of age, ask him."
All right, let's break this down. First of all, thank you, and look at this. This man comes back, and there are people who know him, who see him. How do they react? Amazed. They're just amazed by this. They just see the evidence. And again, this chapter is about perception. What do your eyes see? Go with that. Right. Even as hard as it is, believe what you're seeing. As opposed to people who see But they won't believe here. So, these people here who sort of are the objective party, they're like, what has happened to you? They know he's got his sight now. And they knew he'd been begging and he's been a man blind all his life. And the man immediately knew who it was who healed him. Unlike, let's say, the Pool of Bethesda, when the man who was paralyzed, you know, got help, he really didn't know who Jesus was and that kind of thing. This man knew who it was. This is further on in Jesus' ministry. He's been in Jerusalem already once, twice. This is probably his second time, and there's quite a stir about him. And he's begging in a public place. He's not going to be begging in a place where there aren't people. And so Jesus' notoriety here makes him known to this man. So he knows that it's Jesus. Then we're introduced to two groups of people here. I think it's two groups. First of all, they go and get the Pharisees. After all, if you've got some kind of religious thing or spiritual thing, the common people, the first people they would go to who they thought were the experts were the Pharisees. And behind them or backing them, the scholars, the scribes. Okay? Now, what troubled the Pharisees about this incident? And we're told at the very beginning of the Pharisees section there in verse 13. Happened on Sabbath. And we've seen that issue before. And we talked about this Sunday, didn't we? How that they sometimes would recognize a miracle would take place, but they were so dismissive of it and troubled by it because it took place on the Sabbath day, which is just a ridiculous kind of way of handling the thing. And what happens as far as a division among the Pharisees? When they see the evidence and hear this information, there's a divide among them. What is it? Okay. That's one group of Pharisees. Another group is saying what? Right. So their tradition was telling them this can't be a good thing because it was done on the Sabbath, but yet their eyes are telling them this is the power of God. He's got to be from God. Understand that there's really two groups that are mentioned here. There's a transition. In verse 18, it says, the Jews did not believe that he had been blind. Now, what are we talking about here when it says the Jews? This is one of those nuanced things in especially the Gospel of John. Now, sometimes it just means all the Jewish nation, the Jewish people. But in certain contexts, when there is an organized, smaller acting official group called the Jews, it's talking about the leaders. Of which the Pharisees were some. So really, this is most likely the Sanhedrin Council, who didn't always operate officially, sometimes unofficially, like any governing body does. Sometimes they have planned official gatherings, and sometimes they just have de facto operations, you know? Like, yeah, the town council got together down at the coffee shop and talked about something, okay? Four of the five members were there. That can happen. It's very common in John's gospel when there's a reference to the Jews, and unfortunately this has led to a lot of misinterpretation, thinking there is a lot of prejudice in the gospel of John toward Jews, which doesn't make sense because both Jesus and John are Jews. But oftentimes when it says the Jews, it's a reference to the Jewish leadership. Because here, instead of just openly kind of conversing about this, what do we make of this? This is now a body that's acting to interrogate first the parents and then the man, and then they take official action against the man. So this is a body of leaders here, and that was mostly made up of Sadducees, the majority of them, but there was a minority representation usually in the Sanhedrin Council of the Pharisees. So it's both of them. And that's why, as you see, as the Gospel of John unfolds, you'll see the Pharisees and Sadducees starting to come together to form a united front against Jesus to do him in, especially after the resurrection of Lazarus in John 11. So, the Jews interrogate his parents. Why? They don't believe he's born blind. And even born blind is a lot more severe than just blind, because that meant that one time they had sight, but maybe something happened and they regained their sight. If you never had sight, that's a completely different condition. It's more extreme, isn't it? And so they want to know, was this man born blind? What do the parents say? Yeah, he was born blind. But they're treading carefully. They're really good at PR, the parents are. What do I mean by that? They're treading carefully. They're saying, yes, he was born blind. He's begging because he's blind, but all this does reflect a commoner kind of status among all these people. Definitely they do. And this outcasting is going to factor in large here as we'll see it unfold. They want to know if he's born blind. They say, yeah. What answer do they not provide regarding their son? The event of how he was healed. Now, if my child told me they got healed of their blindness, I'd want to know how they got healed, especially if they were born blind. I'd know all about it, and I'd be happy to furnish that information. They don't. And actually, they do a dodge. They pass the buck. What do they say when they say, how was he made whole? How was he healed? What do? Ask him. They pawn it off on their son. Right. Now, if not for this last statement that is parenthetical in most of our English translations, we would just think, well, they just didn't know the particulars. That's not the reason. Why do they dodge the question about how he was healed? They were afraid of this Jewish leadership casting them out, which meant they could not come to the temple and worship and perform the rituals at the temple, and it also meant they couldn't gather in the synagogue for the community gathering of the readings and the prayers and the songs they did in the synagogues. And they're afraid that if they cite Jesus as the source of the healing, they're going to be ostracized. So they dodge that completely. That's why they do that. So the Jews, the leadership, brings in the man who was healed. They interrogate him. When they interrogate him, it appears by what they say in verse 24 that they're actually recognizing what? What fact? The miracle. Because they say, give God the glory. We know that this man is a sinner. They're trying to dismiss the healing from Jesus, trying to separate it. Why are they having to separate it? If the parents are PR-ish, these guys are political. Why are they having to separate it? Can they deny there's a miracle? Nah. They just got to disconnect Jesus from it. And the way they do that is calling him a sinner. And what's the basis of them calling him a sinner? He's doing something on the Sabbath. Okay? So that's already come up. It's just crazy kind of reasoning. Now, they're trying to get this man to give God glory for the healing. This man, though, is stubborn. He's stubborn with the facts. What stubborn fact does he lay out here in verse 25? Okay. I was blind, now I see. Can't deny that. And regarding him, I can't attest whether he's a sinner or not, but the first thing he says, I can see. Okay? And then they said to him, what did he do to you? How did he open your eyes? Okay, I told you already. So some of them, he's already told them. He's already told the Pharisees. So some of them, he's already told them, but he's asking, do you want me to repeat it? Okay? So they're trying to wear him down to see if they can find some inconsistency in his testimony. He keeps turning things on them. And so when they say, well, tell us again what happened, he goes, I've told you. And then he asks them a question. What question does he ask them?
You want to be a disciple too?
Which is indicating where this man is at with Jesus. And of course, that just really, it just gets in their craw. Okay, it flies all over them that he says this to them. And they downplay Jesus by saying they don't know what about him. His origin, where he's from. Okay, could this mean his place of birth, his family, his background, what's his pedigree, what's his credentials, or even more broadly, because Jesus says, talk about this in the Gospel of John, of the devil or of God. Jesus talks about that sometimes. Because the more they push him, It actually unfolds in this incident the reality of who Jesus is. If they would have hushed him up and got him off to the side, they'd been better off for their purposes. But that's not how they operate. And Jesus oftentimes is challenging them, doing these things on the Sabbath. And so they step right into it. And actually, by pressing him, the case is made even stronger that Jesus is the Christ. Very perceptive, pick that up.
They underestimated this man. They thought they could take him.
They really underestimated this man. You see that staircase going up here toward Jesus, don't you? I mean, when they say, we don't know where this man is from, he has a very logical reply in verses 30 to 33. What is his logical response? We have miracles in the Old Testament. Somebody help me. And I actually didn't look this up, so I didn't do the homework, so you help me. Is there an incident in the Old Testament of a person being blind and being healed? I don't know one in the Old Testament. Am I missing one? Okay. I'm going to blame all of you if there's one and I didn't know it. But it may be the hyperbole, or it may be exactly the truth that nobody has ever. We've had people raised from the dead. We've had people healed of leprosy. We just referenced Naaman. But he says, well, of course, his power shows where he's from. He's from God. And he makes several points about Jesus in verses 30 to 33. He can open eyes of the blind. Okay. He's somebody that God is listening to. Verse 31. And then verse 33, if this man were not from God, he could do nothing. And by nothing, he means these kinds of things he's talking about, and that's opening the eyes of the blind. And this gets to the point there about the leaders. In verse 34, when somebody said they're underestimating this man, in verse 34, what do you see in these leaders in the statement they make to him?
Arrogance.
Arrogance.
We don't know where he's from. He said one part that explained it all.
Right.
Why? Totally incredulous. How in the world do you not see this?
Right.
Because they don't want to.
Right.
And when he points out that they don't want to, then they start to make up.
They have to attack him personally because they can't deal with the reality of what happened, the evidence of what happened. So they have to discredit him now and tear into him as a person. You were born in utter sin. That's going back to what ideology?
Whose sin caused this?
That's right. Back in verse 1 and 2, when the disciples saw Jesus look at this man and asked that question, it was not uncommon, it was common, for certain religious people to believe that if you were in extreme physical, disadvantage or handicap or sickness, that somehow you sin to bring it on. But that's not something just in the New Testament, right? Who else thought that?
Job's friends.
And I still encounter believers who will make statements like that. Oh, they must have done something terrible for that to happen to them. Not necessarily. Maybe not. Look at all the terrible things that happened to Job. Look at all the terrible things that happened to Jesus. What did he do to deserve all that? So here they're right back to this human way of thinking. This is our judgment system. This is our world system. Our how we think things work. You're wrong because you were born in sin after all. And we know you were born in sin because you were made more blind. And again, they're missing the whole point. He's not blind anymore. Matter of fact, he's seen better than any of them. Right?
He says in verse 30, it's amazing that you do not notice. He's saying,
you're blind.
You guys ought to be able to see this.
Yeah.
Of all people, you the religious leaders, you ought to be able to see it.
Perception is all in this. And by perception, we don't just mean with the eyes, we mean with the mind and the heart. Perception is all laced all through this incident. Yes.
Regarding not knowing who he was,
in John chapter 7, right after the Feast of Booths, where Jerusalem is filled with all these people, you know, there's a discourse going on. They're saying, yeah, we don't know where this man is from. And they said, Jesus cried out in the temple, you both know me and where I am from. Yeah. I mean, he's saying, it's obvious where I'm from.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they knew it, but they just wouldn't accept it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a running debate in the Gospel of John. Where is Jesus from? The running question. And here it is again. And this evidence is the mound of it, and they can't see it. Okay? And so what's the consequence for the man testifying to the miracle and his conclusion about Jesus being from God? What's the consequence that he gets? He's cast out, which meant that officially he can't be received in the temple area nor in the synagogue. Now, already as a blind man, he was a social outcast. There were certain things in the law of Moses that limited, if you had some kind of physical malady, that limited what you could do and where you could be. But even just de facto, you see that he's a beggar. He is a social outcast. Well, now he has an opportunity with sight to be accepted in the community, to be one of the guys. But in order for him to be accepted, he's got a cave. He's got to go along with these guys, these people, these religious leaders. He doesn't. So before, he was an outcast because he couldn't see. Now, what?
An outcast because he can. And it, I know I kind of beat it in the ground, but it impresses me as you go along in that chapter how bold he becomes.
He becomes so bold.
And that really impresses me because I'm thinking about how meek and mild he may have been at the time, you know, when he was blind. And he would have never spoke up. He would have never said, I've told you this already. Did you not listen? You know, I mean, and so that strength that he's gaining from this healing and then the spiritual impression that now it's leaving on him, the believing, you know. I guess I've read that many times, but for some reason tonight it just really hit me with that. Wow, he really got bold. You know?
Yeah. He is one of the most impressive people that's healed by Jesus, I think, in the Gospels. In part because it's fleshed out more, so we get a little bit more of a window into what's going on. Right. But you're right. He was a blind beggar. Now he's a bold proclaimer of who Jesus is. And Jesus isn't done with him. Okay? He is not done with him. Zach, will you read verses 35 to 41, please?
Jesus heard that they had cast him out, and having found him, he said, do you believe in the Son of Man? He answered, and who is he, sir, that I may believe in him? Jesus said to him, you have seen him, and it is he who is speaking to you. He said, Lord, I believe, and he worshipped him. Jesus said, for judgment I came into this world, that those who do not see may see, and those who may see may become blind. Some of the Pharisees near him heard these things, and said to him, are we also blind? Jesus said to them, if you were blind, you would have no guilt. But now that you say, we see, your guilt remains.
Right, thank you. There's a textual variation in the manuscripts. English Standard here says Son of Man. Some translations say Son of God. Son of Man was synonymous to the Messiah. The way Jesus uses it doesn't mean in every context that it is, because it pops up in the book of Ezekiel. But it's in the prophets where Son of Man becomes messianic, and Jesus refers to the Son of Man many times, third person talking about himself, in messianic tones. And so it's in essence the same thing here. Do you know who the Son is? And he's like, he didn't really know. And he reveals himself and then he confesses. And this is what we're just talking about, Kathy's comment there that last time. What do you see in this man? Kathy, you said he's so bold. What else do you see in this man? What do you see in this man? Because this whole story starts with what? Jesus saw a man.
His humility precedes his boldness.
Yeah, the humility of condition preceded the boldness. It's an interesting transition there. Yeah, what else do you see?
Well, I see a man that sees Jesus.
Yes.
Both literally, physically, and spiritually.
Right. And see for who he really is. And that's why he calls him Lord and worships him, which is a response to deity. Lord could mean just one, a superior, but in this context of worshiping him, it's a term of deity. Yes.
Well, as his sight became clearer, the Pharisees and the Jewish leaders became blind and more blind.
Sure did. Sure did. What a contrast. And that's why Jesus ends it with this statement, I've come so the blind can see and those who see.
You see a man with no hidden agendas.
Yeah, he's honest. He's got guts, and he's devoted to the truth of what happened and the truth about Jesus, come what may. He's willing to confess his faith and make it known. This man has moral courage. That moral courage is born out of his faith. You have something,
I wonder if the way he reacts, some of how he felt about things could have been preceding this healing. Like, you wonder how a lot of the people in the populace felt about the Pharisees and the scribes. Mm-hmm. They knew they were pompous. And he was a man who had some enhanced other abilities, his perceptions. So, maybe it's a little glimpse into Jewish life.
Yeah.
And I'm not arguing at all, but there's a lot happened. We don't know if he was necessarily humble prior. He had to be humble in some regards. But.
Yeah, he was in a humble condition, absolutely. Yeah. Begging.
Yeah.
Okay, which is really his choice. And at least by this point, he's got their number.
Yes.
Okay.
You know, it's interesting that many people identified the Pharisees by the way they dressed. He wouldn't have been able to determine that.
Yeah, that's true. That's interesting. They
would have known by their language, the way they were speaking.
And how they reacted to it.
And the other thing I was thinking when Ray was saying that was, it would have been very easy for Pharisees or people walking by him speaking without thinking that he's even paying attention.
Mm-hmm.
And that he's actually hearing them. And I'm sure he heard lots of conversations.
Right.
You know, I'm just assuming, but just imagining
right. And
being there. And so, again, he would know people by the way they spoke.
Yeah, okay, he's going to pick up a lot, isn't he? Like we talked about, blind people do. And I would propose this, that the Pharisees never saw him the way Jesus saw the man.
Right. Definitely.
Okay, this is somebody that they would marginalize. A couple things here, and that is, understand, Jesus talks about the Father and him working by day. But Jesus' real work here is not giving this man sight through his eyes. That's not his ultimate work. That's a means to a goal. His ultimate work is drawing faith out of this man. Faith in Jesus and helping him see that he was the Christ. That's the great thing that Jesus did for this man. And I want you to see, too, that this is like a microcosm of discipleship. And by that I mean, he heals this man or saves him or delivers him. But then, look what the man has to do. He sort of like leaves the man on his own. Do you see that? Finds him later and talks to him. Jesus leaves him on his own, okay? Is he going to believe in me or not? Is he going to stand on his own 2 feet on his faith in me? And it's just how we're called to defend faith in Christ after we're saved and delivered. And that as a result, sometimes we're tested with consequences of our faith, including sometimes social consequences. This is a microcosm of discipleship. This is what Christ does for us, and then this is what he calls us to do for him. Defend faith in him. And no matter what price we have to pay or what test we have to pass, stick to that faith in him, regardless of the outcome. That's what this man had to go through. And you see people doing this over and over in the book of Acts.
Okay, thank you so much.